All right, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Zayin Umad Aleph. Here the Gemara is addressing the fundamental question that was presented yesterday, which is, Ivailuhu, Hespeda Yakra de Chayhave, or Yakra de Shachvehave? When it comes to the eulogy, the Hespeda that's given, is that for the Kavoda mate, or is that for the Kavoda Chaim? And we saw already, Nafkamino, that the Gemara brought, first of all, can someone waive the need for a eulogy? That depends on who the eulogy is for. Who has to pay for the eulogy? Can you compel the Yorshim to have a eulogy? That also might be a factor, depending on whose kavod it is for. There are nafkamino halacha with regards to this, and the Gemara has been going through different proofs. Now on the top of Mem Zayin Amar Aleph, the Gemara brings a proof from the Tfilim, Perek Tetvav, which is, Mizbala David Hashem mi agur bo alecha, mishkon bahar kochecha. And then the Perek Tehilim goes through, Olech Tamim, Upol Tzedek, Dover Emet Bilvavo, all the right things that a person does. Now the pasuk there says, Nibza be'inav nim'as, ve'jirei Hashem yichabed. And so a good person is someone for whom a contemptible man is abhorrent, and he honors those that fear Hashem. Though as you'll see in Rashi, the Gemara will slightly vary the interpretation to say that those that denigrate themselves or waive their kavod, they can still create a Kiddush Hashem or a Kavod Hashem. So, this refers to Chizkiyahu Melech shegirer atzmot aviv amitah shel chavalim. He dragged the bones of his father, Achaz, the Rasha, on a bed of ropes. This is, the Gemara in Pesachim discusses that Chizkiyahu Melech did six things, three of which the Chachamim approved of, three of which the Chachamim did not approve of. One of the items that he did, which the Chachamim did approve of, was that which he did to his father's bones. We'll see in a second, do something to indicate to the people there was a huge change going on here. Chizkiyahu HaMelech leads a tshuva movement. He overhauls the system of Avodah Zarah that's there. He does a tremendous amount in terms of changing the attitude and the religious norms that were present in Yehuda. So as part of that, he takes out his father's bones and drags them along the way. Now, if the whole point of the eulogy or anything that happens after death is for the honor of those that are alive, my taima, why would he do this? I mean, what point is there in dragging around the bones of his father if, in the end, it's all about Chizkiyahu HaMelech? If it's one thing, if it's about his father, Achaziyahu, where he's dragging him around and it has impact in terms of the mate, then that's one thing. But if it's all for his own honor, Chizkiyahu HaMelech, then when he drags around the bones, what has he done? The Gemara says, Keichitavilei kapara labua. So then his father can attain kapara. The Gemara says, Umishum kapara dabua, mishaule the yakra di Israel. For the kapara of his father, we'll call it postpone, or we push off the honor of Klal Israel. Which means that here, yakra de chaye is the factor in eulogies and all things that happen after the death of the individual, then the relatives or the people who are getting the honor out of this is all of Klal Yisrael. We're talking about the king of Israel. And so if the king of Israel passes away, anything done for the king is not done for the honor of the king, it's done for the honor of the people of the king. So that case, if you make a decision to do something in particular to the benefit of the king, how can you do that at the expense of Klal Yisrael? What right did he have to do that? So the Gemara says, Yisrael gufayu nechaluhu, temechle yakarayu legabe. That this is something that Bnei Yisrael themselves are benefiting from or would be pleased with, and therefore they're mochel on their kavod. We saw a similar referring in the Gemara yesterday with regards to Abraham and Sarah, which is that how could it be that Sarah was laying in wait for Abraham to show up and to give a hesped for Sarah? If the whole purpose of the hesped is lechayek for Abraham, how could you then be mochel on kavod of Sarah and leave her hanging around for Avraham's benefit? The answer is that Avraham's kavod is in the interest of Sarah. So there is this interplay between the mate and those that are alive. We'll see it more explicitly here in the Gemara in a second. But I discussed yesterday the idea of waiting for relatives and certain things that we do with the mate, even though it's not the kavod of mate, it's really a kavod of chayim. But in those situations, the kavod ha-chayim might turn into kavod ha-mate. To have the children of the mate be present at the levaya is like a kavod ha-mate, even though the truth that it's a kavod ha-chayim, it's so that the children can be present at the levaya. So there is this interplay between them, and that's what the Gemara is saying here as well. even though it is possibly Yakro Dechaye, and it's Yakro Dechaye, then why drag around the bones? What does that do for you? The answer is, okay, it gains him kapara. Well, if it gains you kapara, then you're doing something to benefit the mate at the expense of those that are alive. What right do you have to do that? The answer is that even those that are alive see benefit in that, or think of that as being something positive, and therefore they'll waive their kavod in order to the other person to gain the kapara. Now Rashi over here says, the reason that he did this to his father is because he dragged him around derech bizayon. It was a denigration of the body of his father. His father was evil. Ubizau leinekol. So why did he do this? Kadeshi tiasru acherim. To teach other people that this is the wrong way to be, and that what his father had done was incorrect. And Chizkiyahu was willing to waive his own kavod. Ve'pnei kavod av, nami lekalamechash. What about kibud avayim? Why is he not bound by that? Because we have the pasuk with nasib amcha k'tiv, v'musei masei amcha, that the requirement of kavod, both towards the king and towards the parent, is only true when he's osei masei amcha, when he is a person that keeps the halacha, a person who follows the precepts of the Torah. But a person over here who doesn't keep those precepts, there's no obligation of him in terms of kibud av. Nivze beinav, hu atzmo nitbezeh, v'nim as bifnei atzmo. Here it's saying about Chizkiyahu HaMelech that he allowed himself to be denigrated in a sense, that he didn't worry about his kavod, but Malkum Kiddush Hashem, in the place of Kiddush Hashem. Here you have Chizkiyahu HaMelech acted in a way that was beneath his dignity as the king. Nevertheless, he was doing it because he was a Yirei Hashem, because he wanted to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim, and therefore he is praised for doing such a thing. Now, the idea that this is a kapara for his father is very difficult. The Rabbi Kiva Eger already notes this, which is Rashi in the upcoming sugya is going to say that ilav yakra deshachve, if it's not for the honor of the mate, amay mechaper bizyona, then why is the denigration a kapara? You can only have a denigration be a kapara if it's meaningful to the mate. So over here, if you say that the whole thing here is yakra dechaye, it has to do with the honor of those that are living, then anything that happens post the death, if that's all for the honor of the living, then it doesn't have any impact on the mate. If you don't give him that kavod, the mate is not hurt by that. It doesn't affect the mate at all. So now you have a play here between the two concepts, which is, if it's to the benefit of the mate afterwards, then when it's not done, it's an affront to the mate, and that provides a kapara. But if it's something that is not the right of the mate, but rather it's yakra dechaye, it belongs to the honor of those that are alive, then when you don't do it, it's not a bizayon for the mate, because the mate doesn't care about her. It's not for his honor in the first place. So that's what the Rabbi Kiva Eger asks on Rashi. He says, "Ubizau leinei kol kadesh yitiasu acherim." Rabbi Kiva Eger says, "How could it be?" Mekashon. We're going to say, based on the Rashi coming up, why is the bizayon over here have any bearing? Because you can only have kapara if it was for the honor of the mate. Well, if you think it's Yakov Dechaye, how could he be bringing a kapara to his father? So the Ran answers that question of Rabbi Kiva Eger by saying that interplay between the Chaim and Meitim is impactful over here. The king wants the people to get the honor in his burial, and the lack of that honor to the people in his burial reflects poorly on the king. And therefore, even though it's Yakra de Chaye, nevertheless, there might be kapara when there's a lack of kavod to the Chaye, because it does impact on the Shichve, it does impact on those that have passed away. Again, you see that interplay between those that are alive and those that have passed away. I think that you could answer the question by saying that even though it may be shvikvod ha-chayim, if you do something that is denigrating towards the mate, then that already is beyond what we'd say just giving up the kavod mate. That is something that is like a bizoy to the mate. So you have to differentiate between things that are not doing a kavod, which is neutral versus being a positive statement. Over there, the mate will not gain kapara from that lack of kavod. But if you do something that's a bizoy to the mate, you do something that's really negative towards the mate, even if it's all for the kavod of chayim, if you do that to the mate, that already gains a certain amount of kapara. That's how you would answer the issue that's raised by the Kivegi over here, is to differentiate between neutral, where you don't give kavod, versus negative, where even if it wasn't the akra de shachve, it still gains a certain amount of kapara. Tashma. Amar lehen, al tizbiduni ba'ayarot. Rabbi in the Gemara Kedubot tells us that he instructed his children that they should not eulogize him in the cities or the smaller cities, rather in the larger areas. If you say the whole point of the eulogies is for the benefit or the kavod of those that are alive, why does he care where the eulogies are carried out? Why does he have any interest or even any say in the matter? Again, he thinks that it would be a greater honor for Klal Yisrael if the eulogies that are given for such a leader, the Nasi, the religious leader of Klal Yisrael, that if they are done in larger groups, that would be a greater kavod for Klal Yisrael. And so he's thinking, even though it sounds like something that's kavod ha-meit, it really has application for kavod ha-chayim, because in that way, they will end up with a larger eulogy, which would actually be more kavod for Klal Yisrael as a whole. All right, now the Gemara says, Tashma, halinu likvodo, Sar Mishno, if you leave him overnight for his own kavod, meaning that you don't bury the mate for something that's for his benefit, lavilo aron v'tachrichim, the examples that are brought in the Mishnah is to bring him a coffin, to bring him tachrichim, enu avir alav, then you're not in violation of a lotalin because you're doing it for kvod ha-meit. My lav, the kvodo shel meit, that's what it sounds like. The reason that you're allowed to leave the mate over is because all of these items are kvodo shel meit. So again, seems to lean heavily in favor of saying that that which we are doing is for the kvod ha-meit, and that kvod ha-meit is also what grants you the right to not bury the mate immediately, to be mailing the mate in order to provide him that kavod. Lo, kvodo shel chai. No, it's for the kavod ha-chayim. Where it says, mishum kvodo shel chai, mevit lay the mate. So the word bat in Aramaic means to sleep over, to stay over, like a malone. So over here it means, so for the kavod ha-chayim, mevit lay the mate. You're going to leave the mate overnight for something that's to the benefit of those that are alive in Kiyamai Rachmono, because the Torah says this, Lo talin nivlato al eitz, you may not leave the body hanging on the tree, but here it's really a piece of wood. Dumia de talui. The Torah compares or puts the restriction compared to those that are hanged. Dibbe bizayon, because there is something negative of a halacha. Kevin de leitli bizayon, lo. Over here, where there is no bizayon, then it's not a problem. So here again, you have this interplay between bizayon, neutral, and kavod, which is that even if you believe that it's kavod ha-chayim, which is that anything you do post the mitah all has to do with the remaining living relatives, and that's for their kavod, so now you're doing certain things then at the expense of the mate. Are you allowed to do that? What right do you have to do things at the expense of the mate? The answer to that question is, it depends. What are you giving up in terms of the mate? If it is that the mate is going to be bizayon, then you don't have a right to do that. For instance, if he's hanged and he's on the wood overnight, that is a bizayon to the mate. In that situation, you're in violation of lotalin, leaving the mate there. But if the mate is in state, he's kept in a way that is not a bizayon a mate, that is not a problem. So that's what we're saying here. If it's neutral to the mate and it's kvod ha-chayim, then we're okay with that. If it's a kvod ha-chayim at the expense, meaning at the bizayon ha-meit, that we're not okay with, and that we can't do. So that's another qualification now that's been brought in here in terms of the interplay between kvod ha-meit and kvod ha-chayim. You can see here, as the Gemara goes through the different proofs, it's starting to narrow the difference between kvod ha-chayim and kvod ha-meitim, because each time it says that they aren't so independent. We've already determined that the kvod ha-chayim might be affected by the kvod ha-meit, which is that we would leave over the kvod ha-meit because the mate might be benefiting from the kvod ha-chayim, that it might be a kvod to the mate to allow the chayim to have kvod. Now again, we said the same thing here, that only if it's a bizayon to the mate will we not allow it to be kvod ha-chayim. So again, here are these qualifications that allow for that interplay. Tashma, ilinu lichvodo, lishma ala vayerot, they leave him over for his kvod. Lishmoa la vayerot means to go and announce. Lishmoa vayishma in the Navi means to go and announce or to gather the troops together. So lishmoa la vayerot is to send around the messengers to call people for the funeral. Lavilo mikononot, or to bring professional criers and wailers. Lavilo aron v'tachichim inu over alav. Then there's no violation. Shekola oseh inu elo lichvodo shel meit. So there also, it seems explicit here, that the only reason that they're doing this is because of the Kvodo Shomet. So again, here, it seems like all the preparations and all the things that are done after the death are the Kvodo Shomet. So Achikamar, no, don't read it literally, the Kvodo Shomet. Ela Kolo say the Kvodo Shochai, Ein Bo Bizayon Mait. In all these instances that you're doing this for the Kvodo Chaim, none of these items are a Bizayon to the Mait, and therefore would be permitted for those that are alive. Tashma, Rabbi Natan Omer, Siman Yafel Mait, Shinifraim Imenu Lachar Mita. It is a positive sign to the mate that they take retribution from him after his death. Mate shelo nispad velo nikbar, a mate that was not eulogized or not buried. O shechaya gorerato, or an animal's dragging him around. O sheyu gishamim zalfim amitato, or they're burying him and it's raining on him. Zeu siman yafel mate. All of these are positive things for the mate because in all these instances they're taking retribution on the mate. That's a denigration to the mate, and that's a kapara, and that means that the person is gaining their olam haba, or their reward, because that which they were supposed to be punished for is being taken care of post the mita. So this is a way to take out all these sins, expiate the individual, so now they can go up to olam haba when these negative things happen after they have died. Shmamina, yakra deshachveyo, shmamina. You see from this that it must be that all these issues are the honor of the mate. And this is where Rashi says what the Rabbi Eger quoted before, which is, if it's not for the honor of the mate, then why is any denigration, any bizayon here, a benefit or a kapara to the mate? And so you see here that there are certain things that are simanim, tovim for the mate, because they bring kapara to the mate. Now, Bali Tosafot yesterday qualified this and said that it's Siman Yafel HaMeit is not that they don't eulogize them at all, or they don't bury them at all, because we see in the Navi that that's in a sense a curse. When their bodies are left to rot out, or there's no eulogies, that's something for the Rishayim. That's not something that we would say for a person who's just getting a little kapara. But rather, the way the Rabbi Bali Tosfot stated is, it was Eino Lifrik Vodo. It wasn't up to the stature or the proper standing of this individual. He did not have a hespate like he should have had. He didn't have a funeral like he should have had, that should have been fitted. This individual was becoming for this individual. That's what it means here, lo nispad, no nikvar. These individuals didn't get what they were supposed to get. But if you're totally out of a hespet, totally out of a kvura, that already is beyond the pale. I mean, that's such a denigration, that's only reserved for the Rishayim, and that's not a siman yafeh anymore. So here, the Gemara concludes that everything we do afterwards is yakra deshachveh, is for the benefit or the kavoda mate, and then everything has to be weighed on that scale. That, and based on that, you have to think about what you do in terms of the mate. So now, in terms of Yechizkiel HaMelech, makes a lot of sense why he dragged his father around, because it was Yachud HaShachmet. So he could provide kapara to his father. He could be, the bizayon could be significant in the fact that he did it post his father's death. All these things that we wait for do for the mate, makes sense that we wait to do it for the mate because it's things that are kavod mate. And so we would wait for having the mate wait for his own kavod makes sense because then in the end it's a kavod mate. And so that's how we're going to explain all of these items. And that means that the eulogy and everything surrounding the funeral all is connected to the mate. There will be those exceptions which we spoke about before, like Avram and Sarah, and which I said before that the Gemara qualified and said that there's certain times that kavod chaim also is kavod mate, or that the mate is interested in the kavod chaim. We said it by Avraham and Sarah, that Sarah sees a benefit in Avraham's kavod, and therefore waiting for Avraham is important. That means that sometimes waiting for children to be present, which is a kavod chaim in some sense, but it also turns into kavod mate, and therefore that's important. And same thing with the king and the people. That the king, even though it might be kavod the king, part of the kavod of the king is that the people get the kavod. And there's an interplay between the king and his subjects, which is that a sign of a good king is subjects that are honored by the king and give honor to the king in his death. So therefore, the king would want a certain type of funeral, a certain way that the people would act, because that reflects on him as a king. So again, if it's Yakre the Shachve, it still doesn't mean that there's nothing left for the Chaim, or that we don't think about the Chaim at all. We will think about the Chaim in the context of the impact that it has on the mate. Lo ayu kovrim. They don't bury him b'kivrei avotav after he is executed by the Beit Din. Kol kach lama. Why can't you bury him b'kivri avotav? V'shein kovrim rasha etzel tzadik. There's not allowed to bury a rasha next to a tzadik. Dama rav acha bar chanina minayim shein kovrim rasha etzel tzadik. How do you know that that is improper? Shnemar. The pasuk says by Elisha, v'yim kovrim ish, v'nei ra'u et agdud. They were burying this individual, and they see a bunch of marauders, army, that are coming in to attack. V'shlichu et ha'ish b'kever Elisha. They threw the individual into the grave of Elisha. Vayelech, vayga, ish, v'atzmot Elisha. Then it touches, or he comes into contact with the bones of Elisha. Vayechi, and he comes alive. Vayokam al raglav, he stands up. And then, the question of what happens after he stands up. The individual was thrown into the grave of Elisha, and then is revived because of this. And it seems like he walks away. Implicit in this, according to Rav Acha bar Chanina, is it would be improper for this individual to be buried next to Elisha. And the reason he came to life was so that he would walk away and not be near Elisha. Who the individual is, Rashi brings the story that it is the Navi Sheker that ensnares or entraps Ido Navi early on in Melachim. Hashem had told the Navi not to talk to anybody or not to stay in Beit El at all. And he complies with that, but then this Navi intercepts him. This Navi Sheker intercepts him and says, I have a word from God that you should eat with me. And he ends up staying there. And then from that violation, he is killed or torn up by an animal. So that Navi Sheker is supposedly the Navi that is buried next to Elisha. It's pretty amazing because the time differential is pretty big. He would have been pretty old by that time. But that's the Midrash that Rashi brings here. So this Navi Sheker is the one who's buried next to Elisha. And this Navi Sheker obviously is a Rasha. And being buried next to Elisha would have been inappropriate, and that's why he gets up. You should know that there are other Midrashim as to who the person was, and they seemingly would disagree with our Gemara, because our Gemara clearly states the person was a Rasha. Other Midrashim don't indicate that the person was a Rasha, or even was someone who was positive. In that case, you wouldn't come to the same conclusion. Now, Amar Lei Rav Papa B'dilmali Kiyume. Maybe it's to fulfill the request that Elisha had of Eliyahu when Eliyahu was Olei Hashamayma, but Inat Pishnayim Ruchacha Eli, that I should get twice the Nebu'ah that you have. Probably the wrong translation of the words. Pishnayim, we translate in the Gemara here, is translating it in that way too, means two times or double. That's the same way that they translate the words in this week's Parsha. This week's Parsha, it says, the Bechor Mikabel Pishnayim, that he'll get a double portion. But that's not really the truth. Pishnayim does not mean double. Pishnayim means two-thirds. Because if you look at this scenario, you have a ben ahuva and a ben esnua. So there are two children, and the bechor gets a double portion. How many portions are there? Well, if you're going to give a double portion, there are three portions. So the bechor gets pishnayim. He gets two-thirds of that which is there. And then if you read that into the words of the Navi in Elisha, it starts to make a lot more sense. What type of request is it that Elisha can say to Eliyahu, give me twice your ruach, give me twice your nevuah? I mean, what ability does Eliyahu have to give more than he has? It doesn't make so much sense. So the right way to read it probably is Pishnai means at least two-thirds of your nevuah. Let me get to at least that status. So that's probably what the Pashup Shad of Pishnaim is. Nevertheless, the Gemara reads Pishnayim literally as being double what Eliyahu had. Amalei, Ihachi, Hainu Detanyo. So he says, if you are right, then what are you going to do with the Braita? Araglav Amad, Ulu Beitolo Halach. That he got up, but he didn't go home. So in that case, he's not really coming to life in order to be alive. He's just coming to be alive to move away from Elisha, because he didn't go home. Ela Ba'ina Pishnayim Eichem Ishkachata, Da'achye. So now you have a problem. If you're going to do double what Eliyahu did, Eliyahu revived the one child. So now, if Eliyahu, when he revived the child during the Ra'av, during the famine, then Elisha also does the same thing by the Isha Shunamit. He revives the child. So that's one. Now, where do you get the duplication? If you believe here, in his death, he causes the person to be alive, then the person went home and lived the life. Then he brought somebody back to life, and it would have been twice as much. The problem is you have a braita that indicates otherwise, and I told you before, there are midrashim that say that he did go home and had children. Those midrashim would be supportive of the question of Rav Papa, whereas Our Gemara rejects that based on this braita that he does not survive and he doesn't do anything besides walk away. So now we have to figure out, how does Elisha get double? Where does he mechaye someone? Amalei Rabbi Yochanan, shripe tzarat Naaman, shishkula kameit. Because he cures Naaman's tzarat, and we know that a mitzora is chashuv mimeit. Yechtiv ani kameit, that when Aaron pleads with Moshe to daven on behalf of Miriam's tzarat, he says that she should not be like a mate. So here you see that tzarat and mate are equated. So a Naaman who had tzarat, if Elisha cured him of the tzarat, he took him from being a mate to being a chay. And so that's how we get the double portion. Then the conclusion is that the reason that this person came to life was so that he would move away from Elisha, and the tzaddik and the rasha would not be buried together. Now, as for the reason why you wouldn't bury a rasha and tzaddik together, you have to indicate something along the lines is that it's a bizayon to the tzaddik. That the tzaddik, it's an offense or an affront to the tzaddik that a rasha is parked next to him when he's gained a certain stature and standing. And to place a rasha next to him would be inappropriate. Something along those lines. I'm sure there are deeper Kabbalistic reasons why a rasha and a tzaddik should not be buried next to each other. But here the Gemara learns it out from Elisha. Kashem shein kovrim rasha etzel tzaddik. So just like you can't bury a rasha next to tzaddik, different levels of rishayim also you need to separate. Yeah, so that's right. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah is indicative of that because the Mishnah says we separate between the different mitot beitin. Depending on the severity of the crime, they're buried in different areas. So that shows you that the separation between Rasha and Tzaddik is not unique. It's also between Rasha and Rasha. Gemara says, why not then divide up the cemetery into four categories? You have four mitot beit din. You should have four sections. How come we only have two sections? Gemara says, Shnei Gvarot Gemara Gemirila. V'alocha l'moch misinai v'sora, that there are only two divisions. And that is, Skila v'sreifer are together, Hereg and Chenek are together. It's interesting only because later on in the Masech, there's Machlokes Rabbi Shimon the Chachamim. As to whether skila or sreifa is more chamor, and same thing with hereg and henek, which one is more chamor. Over here, you don't have to deal with that, because you're putting them together. Sreifa and skila are the most chamor, they're buried together, irrespective of you hold like the chachamim or Rabbi Shimon, you bury them together. Hereg and henek, which are the lighter forms of mita, they're also buried together. So we see that there is a certain amount of division, but it's not as fine as we thought. Now, it's halacha l'moshe misinai, so you can't necessarily darshan the tam of that, but that would then seem that you have to look at broad categories. We're not looking at minutia of whether this person did this or did that, but we're looking at broader categories of mitot. And here, the Gemara's only example, just to be clear, is the case of mitat beit din. It's a case where the person's in violation of something that would require a capital punishment in court. So we're not talking about violators or sinners. Everybody sins. That's what we said in yesterday's Shalechta. Everybody sins. That's not what the divisions we're talking about. We're talking about here people who were in violation of serious and severe isurim in the Torah. But not only that, they were warned not to do it. And they said, I don't care. And they say, you're going to be subject to a death penalty. And they say, I don't care. And then they're put to death. So these people are on the, I would say, the far range of the scale in terms of where they are in terms of avaryanim. I'm not talking about any stam avaryan. So I think that any extrapolation from this has to be done very carefully because of the fact that these individuals are unique. On the other end of the spectrum, we're talking about Elisha and Navi. So you're talking about tzaddik and a Navi, and you're talking about extreme sinners. Everything in between seems to be relatively neutral, and therefore I don't know if people have the right to make differentiations or distinctions along those lines because they're very black and very white, but no gray that is being addressed by the Gemara over here. All right. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Achal chelev v'fish korban. Person eats chelev. Whenever the Gemara wants to give an example of a shogeg that's subject to a korban chatat, chelev is this paradigmatic type of isur that involves a lav that is subject to karet, that if you do b'shogeg is a chatat. So anytime he wants to give an example of an avera subject to a korban chatat, it always uses chelev. So achal chelev v'fish korban v'emir dato. And then he leaves the faith, goes to worship of Avodah Zarah, does something outside the faith, v'chazarbo, and then he returns, he's a Baal Tshuva, ho'ov nitche yidche. Since the Korban was knocked off, it can no longer be brought. Itmar Nami, we have a similar idea. Amar Yirmi, Amar Bibo, Amar Yochanan, Achal Chelev V'fish Korban, V'nishtateh. And he lost his mind. He was no longer of a sound mind. V'chazar V'nishtafeh. And then he became of clear mind again. Ho V'nitcheh, Yitcheh. Since while he was a Shoteh, he could not bring the Korban. The Korban was no longer Ra'ui. Then once it has been pushed off, it's been pushed off. The concept of Dichoy, you spend a lot of time in Kodashim, is this concept that within Kodashim, if an item was ra'ui to go on the Mizbeach, and then for whatever reason it lost the ability to put on the Mizbeach temporarily, that temporary hiatus causes a problem for the Korban permanently, and you can no longer bring the Korban. Now, it is a machloket in Kodashim as to how far that goes. Two different types of dikhoi. There's dikhoi like we're discussing here, which is, it was ra'ui the Mizbeach, and then after it was ra'ui the Mizbeach, it became nidcheh, which is that it was valid and then became invalid. There's also something called dikhoi mi'ikara, which is that it was invalid from the outset, which is, for instance, a case where someone who was not of the faith, someone who rejected their Judaism, went off to Avodah Zarah, sins, and then is mafrisha korban. That korban is dikhoi mi'ikara, because the person who wants to bring the korban is not an individual who has the right to bring a korban at that time. And that's what's called dichoy mi'ikara. Over here, the Gemara brings only the cases of nirev and nidcheh. The Bali Tosafot question that and say, why doesn't it bring the bigger chiddush, which is dichoy mi'ikara? Why don't they bring that down? So Tosafot discusses that issue as to why dichoy mi'ikara is not addressed here, and he feels that that would have been a bigger chiddush and more useful in terms of understanding. Nevertheless, the Gemara is talking about nirev and nidcheh. Now, the Gemara says, v'tzricha, we need both cases. If you only told me about the case of someone who denies his faith or goes off to worship at Avodah Zarah, because he himself caused his disqualification from bringing the Korban. The person who loses his mind, that's something that's not within his control. So maybe we will consider him or classify him as if he was sleeping. Now, even there, it's slightly different, because even when you're sleeping, you're still ra'ui to bring a korban. If someone brings a korban on your behalf while you're sleeping, you're still qualified during that period of time. So even Yashin himself never goes disqualified even when they're sleeping. Nevertheless, the concept is that something that is involuntary, that will eventually be remedied. Person is tired, they go to sleep. Eventually, they will wake up from their sleep. So that's something that will happen by itself. Person who loses their mind, you would have said the same thing. Eventually, they'll come back being of sound mind. So maybe you can compare them to a yeshen in that way. On the other hand, if you only told us about the case of someone who loses his mind, maybe over there, since it's not in his control as to when he becomes of sound mind, that's why it's nidcheh. In the case where he walks away from the faith, since he has the ability to decide when he returns to the faith, emalo. So there too, tzricha, that's why we need both of these items to teach us. Both of them are disqualifications within the korban. What does this have to do with our Gemara? I'm Rav Yosef, anan nami tanina. We have this in a Mishnah, which is, ayubo kodashim, kodshe mizbeach, yamutu. If within an iradidachat, where there is a requirement to kill the residents and burn all of their possessions, part of the possessions of the individual included kodashim. If they are kodshei mizbeach, animals that go on mizbeach, yamutu, they're put to death. Kodshei berek habayit, if they are things that are dedicated for their monetary value to the mikdash, yiftu, then you redeem them. Vavinan ba, amai yamutu. Why should they die over here? Kevin de ikto, habiluhu kapara. The lisko legvoa, once the people of the Irani Dachat are put to death, isn't there kapara that's attained? If they have kapara, then why are the korbanot no longer valid? Certain korbanot will be automatically invalid because they require balim, they require owners. And if the owners are dead, then the korban is no longer valid, like a chatat. But there are other korbanot, like korbanot nedava of a shlamim and ola, that can be even brought post the death of the individual. So now, why is it over here that the korbanot that are found in this year nidachat have to be put to death? Why isn't there an option to bring them post the execution of the individuals in the year nidachat? They've attained kapara. They're now valid individuals, qualified individuals. Why can't we bring the korban? It must be because there is a decoy here. When the Irani Dachad was worshipping Avodah Zarah, then the people had left the faith. So the owners of the Korbanot were disqualified during that period of time. So even though they become qualified again after the Kapara, that interim state or temporary state of disqualification ruins the Korban. So this would be supportive of Rabbi Yochanan's contention that we saw before. So now we have a Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef says, that supports whatever Rabbi Yochanan was suggesting. So Amale Abaye, so student, Abaye says to Rabbi Yosef, Misavart, make mitochu show abile kapara. Who says that a person who dies as an evil individual, person who dies in a sin, that there is kapara. Make mitochu show lo abile kapara. Person who dies in sin is not granted kapara. Because your assumption here is that automatically the people of Eir Nidachat would gain kapara. Are you so certain that's true? Person who dies in a sin or in sin does not gain kapara. The Tani Rav Shmaya, Yochal Afilu Pirshu Avotav Mitarchei Tzibur Itama. You would think that even if his forefathers, you know, it's not really forefathers, it means literally his parents, had not kept the halachot. Pirshu Mitarchei Tzibur over here means they do not follow the ways of the Tzibur, not literally in terms of Poresh Minat Tzibur, that we think about it today, that they've taken themselves away from the Tzibur. The idea of taking away from the Tzibur means that they don't follow the halachot, and that they're not God-fearing, mitzvah-keeping Jews, that the Kohen is not required to become Tamei, or even may be restricted from becoming Tamei. A Kohen is allowed to become Tamei for his 7 relatives. The Rambam formulates it that we force him to become Tamei for his 7 relatives. But that's only true if his 7 relatives are Torah law-abiding individuals. If they are not, then there's no requirement. Tamalomar be'amav, posem ha'se'amav, that it must be amongst his nation, those that are doing what the people of the nation do, which means that they are Torah law-abiding individuals. So the Kohen is only allowed to become Tamei for the 7 relatives if they are Torah-abiding Jews. So what you see from there is that shouldn't he have gained kapara? Why should it matter? If you tell me that a person who dies b'toch risho gains kapara, then the Kohen should always have the right to become Tamei for his 7 relatives. Even if they were Rishayim while they were alive, if they gain kapara at death, then at that point in time, they are cleansed of whatever Rishay is. They are now back b'amav. The Kohen should be able to bury those relatives and become Tamei for those relatives. So over here, you see from that, or the proof is, that even after death, there isn't kapara that's attained. Someone who dies b'risho does not get kapara. It says, "Kamei dechi orche kamayit lo avila kapara neherag mitoch risho kamei delav kiorche mayit havila kapara." Your comparison is incorrect because you're talking about 2 different types of deaths. You're talking about a death which is a natural death, and then you're talking about a death which is an imposed death. By Irani Dachat, they are killing the citizens of the city because of the requirement to eliminate the Irani Dachat. Those lives are being shortened. In that case, that punishment gains the individual's kapara. In a case of natural death, where the person never does tshuva and they die in their sin, then mita is not a kapara in that instance. So you're right, mita is not a kapara, but that's when someone lives a life and dies a natural death. Someone who is killed for their sin, like the case of Irani Dachat, in that case, they will gain kapara. So now we're back to our original question, which is, if they do gain kapara, then why can't you bring the korbanot? The answer must be, like Rabbi Yochanan, that they were nidche. When they turned into Eir Nidachat, they were nidche. And you can't return them, and therefore there's dichoy over here. Teda dichtiv, and I can show you that that's true. Mizmor le'asaf, elu, kim bau goyim benachlatecha, timu et eichel kochecha, nadnu et niblat avatecha, machal le'uf ha'shamayim, basar chasidecha le'chaito aretz. So in Mizmor le'asaf, it says that the goyim entered into your possession, into your land, truthfully into your mikdash. They defiled the Eichal, Kochecha, and then Nunni Vlata Vadecha, they took the corpses of your servants and left them, Achalof HaShemayim, they were eaten by the birds of prey, Basar Chasidecha L'Chayito Aretz, and the flesh of your Chasidim were animal feed. My Avadecha, my Chasidecha. What's the difference between an Eved and a Chasid? Lav Chasidecha, Chasidecha Mamash. Isn't a chasidecha literally a righteous individual? And then avadecha, what are those avadecha then? If chasidecha are the righteous, then avadecha are what? They are hanachta mechayvei dina, Timikara, became Dikto, Kari Lohabadefka. These are people who are subject to the need for a death penalty or punishment for the sins that they violated. And then, before they die, they were problematic. Once they are killed, then they gain kapara, and God calls them Abadecha, your servants. They are turned into Abadim, even though during their lifetime they were not Ovdei Hashem. Nevertheless, in death they become Ovdei Hashem. So you see, the proof from this, Mizmor Le'asaf, is that being killed gains a person kapara. Because over here, Chasidecha and Abadecha are two classes of people, and they're both considered to be Ovdei Hashem. Chasidecha are those that are righteous all along. Abadecha are those that weren't righteous, but become Abadecha because they're killed. Well, say, Al-Kiddush Hashem, or they're killed because they are Jews. And that killing of them, or prematurely bringing about their death, gains them kapara, and therefore they're called Abadecha. Amar Le Abaye, Mika Medayit. How can you compare the cases? Haruge Malchut, Haruge Beitin? You're comparing people that are killed by the government to people who are killed by a Beitin. There's a very different class here. Haruge Malchut, when you're killed by the government, Kemet Shalom Adin Kamiktele, Havilu Kapara. By the government, the non-Jewish governments that are imposing death penalties, where it's not justified, or they don't have a right to kill the individual, that's where you gain kapara. Because the person was killed in an unjust manner. That unjust manner of killing gains the individual kapara. Haruge Beitin came into Bidin Kamikatle, lo avilu kapara. By Beitin, the person that is killed is rightfully killed or justifiably killed because the Beitin adjudicated the case and the Torah says this person should be put to death. Over there you won't get kapara. We have here now a number of distinctions in terms of whether death provides kapara. Abaye suggests over here, person who dies naturally, they do not gain kapara. A person who is killed gains kapara. But over there, the person that's killed, it depends how they're killed. If they're killed unjustifiably, if they're killed, whether it's in a battle or a governmental action, then in those cases you will gain kapara. If they're killed in an action by Beit Din, where the Torah prescribes that death, they won't gain kapara. Teda. And I'll prove it to you from our Mishnah, that's none. Lo yakuvimo tobi kuvot avotav. They do not bury him in his forefathers' graves. Meaning that this individual that's killed by the Beit Din is not buried with the rest of his family. Why not? If you think that an executed person in Beit Din gains kapara, likavru, then let them be buried with their families. They're done. Once they're killed by Beit Din, they're now expatiated of all sins. They got kapara. They should be buried with their family. The fact that we still segregate them after death shows you that there isn't kapara yet. So from this, you would undermine the proof that we brought to Rabbi Yochanan from the Mishnah that says that irani dachat, if you find behemot kodashim there, they're put to death. We thought that maybe that's because even though after death there is kapara, nevertheless they were nitche, and that is basically supportive of Rabbi Yochanan. Abaye now has undermined that and said there is no kapara by mitat Beit Din. By the execution of Beit Din, you don't gain kapara. The answer to the Gemara is no. Mita b'kvura b'inan. You're right. Death in itself is not enough to gain you kapara. You need death plus kvura, meaning the burial also is a part of the kapara. For that reason, you can't bring him back to Kivri Avotav. Because even though he's gaining kapara, the kapara is not completed until he is buried. So the separate burial, part of that which is the bizayona mate, all of that is in part and parcel of the kapara for this individual. So the kapara is gained, but it's gained later than we thought, which is not just at the time of the execution of Beit Din, but after the burial in that separated plot. That's where they gain kapara, because there's a part of the bizayon to the individual. So if that's the case, we're back to the proof to Rabbi Yochanan, because now the Mishnah that says that you can't bring those animals, irni dachat, the people of the Yeridah do gain kapara. After they're executed and buried, they gain kapara. So why not bring their korbanot? The answer must be like Rabbi Yochanan, because they were nitched. There was an interim period where the people were disqualified from bringing korbanot because they were worshipping Avodah Zarah. Where it says, motiv Rav Adar Rava, lo ayu mitablim elo onanim, that the relatives of the individuals executed by Beit Din, they're not allowed to be avelim elo onanim. So we discussed this in the Mishnah, that the emotions you can't control, but avelut, which is this demonstration of the emotions, that we don't do. So avelut is precluded. if they gain kapara, both after they're executed and after they're buried, then why not have them looked at that point in time? They've now been clear of this violation because they got their kapara. Why not have avilut? Being a nami equal basar. That's not enough. Kapara involves another layer, which is the decomposition of the body. So you need mita, which is the execution or the death. You need burial. And then you need equal basar. All of those are part of the process of kapara. Dekanami. You can be medayik this. Diktani nitakela basar. After the body decomposes fully, and all that is left is the bones, our Mishnah tells us that after the person is buried in these special designated plots for the Haruge Beitin, then after the body completely decomposes and the bones are left there, we allow you to collect the bones and then take them back and bury them in the plots of the family. Shmamina, that's when kapara is attained. So you need three things. You need mita, kvura, and ikul basar to reach the kapara. Once that's reached, the person does gain kapara, and you see that from our Mishnah, because then we allow him to be buried with his family. We take away all the restrictions. Now, that will also have implications in terms of avilut. The Gemara tells us in Moed Katan with regards to avilut, that when a person is malakit atzamot, on the day that you gather together atzamot, there's a small amount of avilut that is associated with this. In this case, you would think that you would have to do that avilut, because that person has reached the point of kapara at that point in time, and therefore those laws of avilut that are associated with likud atzamot would be applicable according to this reasoning. Now, in terms of the decomposition of the mate and everything surrounding the mate, why that's a kapara, likely has to do with the nature of the separation of the neshama from the guf. While we're alive, the neshama and the guf are integrated. After we die, then they are separated. The neshama leaves the guf, and that way the guf now becomes an inanimate object, and the neshama moves away. What the neshama does at that point in time is determined by how the person led their life until that point. I mean, speaking this over from, I think, the explanations that Rav Aryeh Kaplan gives in some of his books in terms of Kabbalistic ideas and the ideas of death. And over there, he speaks about the fact that the neshama hovers over the body after death. The neshama wants to rejoin the Creator and become one with the Creator. That's what is said by David HaMelech, that the person's soul should be bound up with the everlasting one, meaning that a Kodesh Baruch Hu, the neshama should be connected to the Kodesh Baruch Hu. How easy it is for the neshama to leave the body and reconnect with the Kodesh Baruch Hu is determined by how the person lived their lives. The more gashmiut, the more aveirot, the more things that were associated with the guf, the harder for the neshama it is to leave the guf. The less the neshama is connected to the guf, the easier it has it to leave the guf. That's what they say about tzaddikim. That tzaddikim, in a sense, look forward to death because that will allow the neshama to rise to God and reconnect with God, because to them the guf is just the kli. On the other hand, people live their lives where the guf is the primary object and the neshama is only secondary. Then when the person passes away, the neshama is heavily connected to the guf. And then anything that happens to the body has an impact on the neshama. And that's why we are careful in the Chevra Kadisha and the burial of the mate. We try to do everything not to be bogeya in the body because it has such an impact on the neshama. But it also has the ability to create kapara, and that's what's happening over here. We're saying that certain things have impact on the neshama, which is the killing of the individual. Then the burial in a way or in a nature that is below their dignity or in a separate plot. Then ikul basar, the decomposition of the body. And the neshama that's very tied to a body that decomposes. And when that thing happens, it's traumatic for the neshama to see the body that was so much of what their existence was about decompose. And that's why you gain kapara through that process. And so that's what they're describing over here. All of these things that happen to the body impact the neshama because of the neshama's attachment to the body, especially in a situation where the person is a sinner or very connected to their body. All right, now Rav Ashi Amar, Avilut me matai ka matchelet. When does Avilut start? Mistimata golel. From the time that basically the grave is closed. Stimata golel, according to Rashi, stimata golel means putting the board on top. He says that they used to put two stones on the side and then a stone on top in order to be the cover, the top of the grave. And according to Rashi, the golel is the piece on top, the stone that goes across the top. And the dofek are the two upright stones that hold it up. That's what Rashi says throughout Shas. And the Balei Tosafot bring the Rabbeinu Tam throughout Shas that disagrees with Rashi. And he shows why that doesn't make so much sense. And Rabbeinu Tam offers the alternative, which is that the golel is exactly what it sounds like, a galal. It's a wheel. It's a circle. Anybody who's been to some of the catacombs in Israel will see many times that the front of the cave that you go into is this massive circle or wheel there. What they used to do is they'd open it up to bury inside, and then they'd roll it back afterwards to burial. That was to prevent both animals from entering in there and getting the bodies, as well as grave robbers from going in there. So they just have this massive stone they rolled over, and the dofek were the stones that you put underneath it. It's the equivalent of what you put under a tire to stop the car rolling. So then they put a rock there to stop that rock from moving. Once you place it in front of the cave, you put those smaller rocks to hold it in place. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam seemingly says is the golel and the dofek. So stimat golel is when you close the cave. That's the end. You're walking away from the burial. Today, it's the equivalent of once you bury the individual, you've covered the grave, and you walk away from the golel. That's stimat golel. That stimat golel is what starts avilut. Now, for people who don't go to the burial, who aren't actually at the graveside, stimat golel is when they walk away from the mate. So that happens many times today. For instance, if a person's overseas and they're going to be buried in Israel, so some of the relatives are going to go with the individual to the burial. Some of them are going to stay overseas. Then when the mate is taken on the plane, the people that remain overseas walk away from the plane. At that point, they become avelim. Because for them, that's stimat golel. That's the end of the burial for them. Those that accompany the mate, stimat golel is only after the mate is buried. So he says, kapara me'imatai ka'avyo. When is kapara gained? Michichazu tzara dekivra purta. Once you see the grave a little bit, meaning you need to have a little bit of time in the grave in order to gain kapara. Hilkach, hol v'idcho, yidcho. So this is another answer by Rav Ashi. It's a very interesting answer. We say in the Mishnah that there is no avilut here. So the way that we looked at it until now is that the reason that the avilut is not coming about is because kapara was not attained. Since kapara was not attained, there is no avilut. Implicit in that is, if kapara was attained, there would be avilut. That's what I just said before. When kapara is attained by the Likut Atzamot, over there you would have avilut, because at that point kapara has been attained, and that was the thing that was postponing the avilut. So then whatever avilut is associated with Likut Atzamot would be valid. Rav Ashi is saying something different. He is saying that avilut has a starting point. If at the starting point avilut does not kick in, avilut is gone forever. You cannot reinstate, you can't bring back avilut at that point. So at the moment that the stimata golel takes place, which is when the avilut should kick in, we look at that point, is it ro'ui for avilut or not ro'ui for avilut? We look there, we say, no kapara yet. Since there is no kapara yet, avilut is suspended, but it's permanently suspended, meaning that avilut is gone legamre. Even though kapara is gained shortly after, that's what Rav Ashi says. Rav Ashi says kapara is gained when you're in the kever for a little bit, but since that's already post the start of avilut, once avilut is suspended, it's suspended permanently. And that means that even though, let's say a day later, technically the kapara is gained, we don't then go and reinstate avilut. Because once avilut is suspended, it's suspended permanently. Rav Ashi's reasoning would then apply that even when you do likut atzamot, there would be no avilut. Because since at the point of stimat golel, avilut was not appropriate, and it was suspended, it then is suspended permanently, and there will never be avilut for this individual, even if they gain kapara. So that's how Rav Ashi deals with the answer. So he doesn't require equal basar. He doesn't require all these other things for kapara. It just says that the kapara is just a little too late for the avilut. Avilut starts before the kapara is gained. And since that happens, avilut is completely suspended. Rashi then asks, how do you have avilut post the regel? Someone has a relative that passes away during the regel. They're buried during the regel. And avilut is only kept after the regel. Why does that work? If you say that at the time of stimata golel, we look, is there avilut that is ro'oi or not ro'oi? And that determines whether it's avilut at all. During the regel, bury the individual, stimata golel took place, can you do avilut then? No. So why don't we say that it's permanently suspended avilut? Why after the regel do we then go and reinstate avilut? So Rashi says something, and it's an important statement, is that avilut is not completely suspended during the regel. You have a problem during the regel, which is that avilut is at odds with the spirit of Yom Tov, or the spirit of the regel. The spirit of the regel is simcha. The spirit of avilut is tzar. And those are incongruous. A person can't be b'tzar and b'simcha at the same time. And so therefore, Avilut can't be practiced during the regel because it's at odds with the simcha. That does not mean that there isn't Avilut. It means that maybe there is Avilut, but the Avilut can't be expressed because of its incongruence with the simcha of the regel. Now, the Ashkenazim actually practice like this. The Bali Tosafot believe that Dovarim Shibitzina apply. That an individual with an Avel during the regel, where they buried someone during the regel, that even though there is no Avelut, Avelut Betzina still applies. The Rambam disagrees, and that's the Minhag HaSfaradim, is that Avelut is suspended completely. There's not even Dovarim Shibitzina. So according to the Bali Tosafot, this is a lot easier to understand, which is that there is Avelut manifest on the regel. It just can't be expressed or can't be done because if it's at odds with the Simcha of the regel. But that means that all you're doing is subverting it until it can be expressed. How do I know that's true? Is that there is a brayta that's brought in the Gemara in Sukkah that says that Anshei Yerushalayim used to carry their lulavim around all day. They would mitzvah so chaviv aleihem that they used to carry around the lulav. They used to go to the shul and daven. He's going to do this, do that. One of the examples that's brought over there is they menachem avilim. They go to comfort the avilim. What do you mean go to comfort avilim? Why are you doing nechamat avilim on cholamoed? Why are you carrying your lulav to do nechama? There are no avilim on regel. The answer is that even though there's no avilut, there is nechama to avilim. And that's what Rashi quotes over here. Rashi says that it's not begamre shari iske rabim noheg beregel. Things that involve the public at large still exist on the regel. Shemenachim oto kol haregel. People can come to comfort the individual, this avel, quote unquote, during the regel. Even though he's not an avel and he can't be bitzar, nevertheless people can come and comfort him. What you see from that is that the Avelut is not completely suspended, and that's why it doesn't go away after the regel. So Rashi is explaining why it's different on a regel versus a situation like this, where you have a executed person in Beit Din while their Avelut is totally eliminated. Although the Yad Ramah does offer an alternative distinction, which is, in the case of the regel, it's an external exogenous variable which prevents the individual from being noheg avilut. On the other hand, in the case of the execution by Beit Din, the person is inherently precluded from having avilut. So when the gavro is not ra'ui for avilut, that suspends it permanently. On the other hand, when it comes to the regel, where it's an external stimuli that is blocking the avilut, once the external stimuli clears, since the gavro or the mate was ra'ui the avilut, then the avilut kicks in. So according to Ravashi, where the kapara is already attained when you're in the grave for a small amount of time, why do you need the decomposition of the body before you move the atzamot? For the opinions before, it makes sense because the reason you can't move the body until it decomposes is because there's no kapara. Once kapara is attained, you can move the bones to the other grave. According to Ravashi, where the kapara is attained shortly after the burial, why do you have to wait for Ikul Basar to move the body to the Kivrei Avotav? The answer is easy. Mishum Dolo Efshar. It's a practical consideration. You can't move a body once it starts to decompose. You only move bones because that's easier to move. So it's a practical consideration, not a halakhic consideration. Halakhically, technically, you can move them. Shortly after they're buried, you can move the body. But since the body's already begun to decompose, it's impractical to move the body. And that's why you have to wait for Ikul Basar. Kavrei de Rav, the burial plot of Rav, I was shakli minei afra l'ishta bat yoma. They used to go take dirt or earth from the grave of Rav, and they used it as a curative for someone who had a very high fever that was one day old. Atu amrle the Shmuel, they went and told Shmuel about it. Amrlo yehu tavdin, it's not a problem. Karka olam hu. It is a part of the ground, it doesn't belong to Rav. And the ground or earth doesn't become asur. Dichtiv, because it says, Vayashlechet afaral kever bnei ha'am. So over there, it's speaking about the tshuva movement that is led by Yoshiyahu Melech. And it says there that Yoshiyahu Melech grinds up all the asherot and destroys everything there. And then he takes the dust and he sprinkles it over kever bnei ha'am, over the graves of the individuals. Mekish kever bnei ha'am labadat kochavim. It compares the graves to Avodah Zarah, because there he's sprinkling the Avodah Zarah on the Kivarim of the Am. So there you see a hekesh between Avodah Zarah and Kivarim. When it comes to something that's attached to the ground, you can't make it a sur. Those gods that are on the mountains, below Harim, Elohim, but not the mountains that are their gods. You can make something asur in Avodah Zarah if it's already detached. And the Pasuk says that you're going to come to these places, you're going to inherit them, and they're going to have their gods on the mountains, or the high mountains. Those gods that are on the high mountains, you have to eliminate, you have to destroy. On the other hand, the mountain themselves, you don't have to destroy. And that's the limud, or the diuk, that the chachamim make out of the Pasuk, that Avodah Zarah, someone worships a mountain, the mountain doesn't become asur. Someone worships the sea doesn't become asur. The sun, the moon, whatever these things are, they don't become asurim. What does become asur is if they detach something and make it into Avodah Zarah. Similarly, by graves, even though the mate is koneh mekomo, and the mate makes anything associated with them asur ba'ana, that's only true of something that's detached. Something that's mechubar, the karka, does not have that status because you can't make something mechubar the karka asur ba'ana'a. Now, how mechubar the karka has to be is a good question. Is mechubar the karka mean something that is virgin earth that was never touched before, or bedrock that was never touched? Or is mechubar the karka even the dirt that was dug up and then replaced, that can still be considered mechubar the karka? That's a machloket within the mifashim as to what is classified as mechubar in this case in terms of the earth. So Meitavei, is that really true? A chutzev kever la'aviv, someone who quarries out a burial place for his father, v'alach v'kivro b'makom acher, ends up burying his father somewhere else, or izelo yikaver bo olamit, that kever becomes a sur bahana'a, because it was designated for his father, it was dug out for his father. So here you have something that was quarried into the bedrock, and you see that it's still a sur bahana'a. So that goes against what we just said. We just said that if it's mechubar l'karka, it can't become a sur bahana'a. Over here, why is it a surbana? Rashi over here says it's not unique to his father. It just happens to be that's the case. It's not just because of kavod aviv. It has to do with the fact that he is a mate and it was designated for a mate. That's what makes it a sur over here. Hakav ma'askinan bekever binyan. The answer is it's not bedrock, but it's something that was a building or some sort of structure that was put up for his father, and that makes it a sur. Look, a mausoleum of sorts, whatever it was that was done. If it wasn't used, it's still a surbana because it was designated for the mate. Now Rashi makes it clear that that's only true if it was built post the death of the individual. It's only when the action was taken after the death of the individual does that item become designated for the individual and then becomes a surbana. A person while they're alive puts together a mausoleum, that doesn't make it into something that is a surbana because it was built while the person was alive. It's only after death where it was specifically built for the person who had passed away, there it has impact in terms of being a surbana. Now, a surbana, if you think it's mechubar l'karka, it's not a problem. Why is it a problem? The answer is binyan kever. We're talking about something that was built. So by avodah zarah, even though you build a house and it's mechubar l'karka, and for tumah and for other items, it's considered to be mechubar l'karka, nevertheless, for avodah zarah, something that was talush, ubsov mechubar, was detached and then reattached, that is considered to be talush for avodah zarah. And similarly, for tumah, for the mate, or yisrana, associated with the mate, it will be considered to be talush. So a house that's built can become a surbana for avodah zarah. It can also become a surbana for the mate. So Gemara says, Tashma, kever chadash mutar bana. Hitil bo nefel a surbana. A new grave that was quarried out is not a surbana. On the other hand, if you bury a fetus that was miscarried there, then it's a surbana. So now, why does it become a surbana? Again, we're talking about something that was quarried into the bedrock. The answer is, achanami bekever binyan. Same thing. It's not that it was in the bedrock. It was a building or some sort of structure that was put up. Tashma. Nimtzata omer shlosh kvarotein. There are three different classifications halakhically within graves. Kever ha-nimtza, a kever that is found. Kever ha-yadua, kever that's known. And kever ha-mazikat rabim, a kever that causes problems for the public at large. Kever ha-nimtza. Kever nimsa is mutar lefanoto. You have a right to remove it. Pineu, if you remove it, mikomo tahor. The place where it is now tahor. Umutar bana, and you have a right now to get anah from that area. The assumption here is that the mate was buried there improperly and without permission. So this individual had a field, and as far as he knew, there were no graves in his field. Shows up one day, and all of a sudden he finds a grave in his field. He knew until now that there was no grave here. There wasn't any Beit HaKavrot was associated with this area. And all of a sudden, he has a grave that's in his yard. So what it is somebody came along and buried their mate there improperly without permission, and that is illegal. You can't make a surbana someone else's property. And so for that reason, if they exhume the mate and move them somewhere else, First of all, the area is not Tameh. And number two is, it's not Asur Ba'anah. Now, even though the Isur Ba'anah is Midoraita, that's only when the person has a right to be buried there. But over here, they didn't have a right to bury them there. You can't make the area Asur Ba'anah. Therefore, when you remove it, it removes the Isur Ba'anah. Kevri Yadua, if you have a grave that is known, and a person was buried there with permission and properly, Asur Lifnoto, then you don't have a right to remove it or exhume the grave. Pineu, if you do that, Mikomotamei Asur Ba'anah. In that case, the makom remains Asur Ba'anah, and the place remains Tameh. As far as Tumah and Tahara, that is a Dindar Abbanan. The fact that it remains Tameh is a penalty Midar Abbanan, because we don't want you exhuming bodies and moving into other places. And since it was a Kerag Yadua, and the mate was Konet Mikomo, then it was Tameh while the mate was there. When you remove the mate, it would be Tahor. Nevertheless, we say that it is still Tameh as a Knas. In terms of Isur Ba'anah, that's a din d'oraita. The kever is Asur Ba'anah, midoraita. And here where you're improperly exhuming the body, the kever will remain Asur Ba'anah, midoraita, and you will have no right to benefit from it. Kever mazik rabim. What happens if there's a kever that's causing problems for the public at large? It's along a major thoroughfare, they find this grave, and now he's making everybody tameh who goes on that thoroughfare. Mutar lifnoto. You have a right to remove the grave because it's to benefit the public at large. Pineu, if you do remove him, mikomo tahor, the place is tahor now because you removed the maid from there. That's a din derabonon to make it tameh. And here they're not going to put a knas to make it tameh because they don't need to dissuade you from moving it. We want to move it to prepare, for to help out the rabbim in general. Vasur ba'anah, but the isur ba'anah, which is a din d'oraita, does not go away over here. They had a right to be buried there. They were buried there properly. Therefore, there is no freeing of the anah. Therefore, there is an isur anah. Here again, you see you have kvarim here, and the kvarim become asur ba'anah, even though it seems that they're buried in the girth or in the bedrock. How come the karkolam is asur ba'anah? Answer again is achanami bekever binyan. We're not talking about kvarim that are in the ground. We're talking about buildings that are above. So that distinction also has impact again today in the modern day, where they're doing building and they bump into kvarim, or they bump into cemeteries, some of this will have impact. Again, it depends on what type of cemetery, what type of mate that's there, what right do you have to move, to exhume the mate. Is this something considered to be a tzorech rabim? If it's not a tzorech rabim, if it is a tzorech rabim, and that has to be determined, what exactly it's called a tzorech rabim, you do have a right to exhume the body, you have an isur anah. The isur anah is only if it was a kever binyan. If it was kever in the karka is not a sur, because we saw from Shmuel that karkolam, and it's not a sur. So you have to then look at what type of grave it was or what type of structure it was. So all these factors will play into those types of decisions. And in this case, you don't have the question that we have in Baba Batra of searching for a Beit HaKvarot over here. It's because it seems that there's circumstantial evidence that the body was put here very recently or it was buried very recently. And for that reason, we know that it's not a Beit HaKvarot, or it's not because it was an older grave that was here. The Gemara says, "Bekever nimtza mutar lifnoto." Just because you found what seems like a haphazard burial there, someone stealing your land to bury a mate, why do you have a right to remove it or exhume the body? Dilma mate mitzvahu. So now the Gemara says, how do you know that the burial was done without permission? Maybe it was done with permission, which is that a mate mitzvah is kone mekomo. Someone finds a body that's just a corpse that's just lying out there. They have a right to bury it on the spot. It's kone mekomo. And you have no right to object to the big grave being put there. So why are you allowed to exhume this body if you have no idea whether it's a made mitzvah or not? Made mitzvah, kone mekomo, kana mekomo. And he was kone mekomo, and you can't remove him. Shiny made mitzvah, dekala, there really was a made mitzvah, it would be coming to the public, it would make the news. A made mitzvah normally makes the news, and the fact that this individual has never heard anything about a made mitzvah and all of a sudden finds a grave in his yard, that's indicative of the fact that it probably wasn't a made mitzvah, because a made mitzvah would have a call. Probably because the people start asking around, whose body is this? Who did it belong to? Who's the mate? That there are questions about a mate mitzvah because nobody knows who the individual is or how they died or how they were killed. So that would make it into a public issue. The fact that this individual never heard about it and all of a sudden finds the grave is circumstantial evidence that first of all it was done recently and it was done intentionally by someone and not a mate mitzvah. Idmar, oreg beged the mate. Someone who weaves Tachrichim for a mate, again, Rashi qualifies this, only achrei a mate, after he died. It's only if this was done post the death of the individual. Bayamar asur, they become asur ba'anah, rav amar mutar ba'anah. Bayamar asur, hazmono milti. Preparations even without a maaseh, are enough to designate something into its purpose. This has implications in many directions. First of all, kedusha. If you make a tefillin bag, but you have yet to put tefillin in it, does that make the tefillin bag kadosh, that you cannot use the tefillin bag for anything else? Can't use it for a pouch for something else? Or does it require that you actually physically put the tefillin inside for it to gain its kedusha? The same machloket that Abai and Rava have here in terms of hasmana milti also applies in the case of a tefillin bag. In cases of, if you designate something to be a beit hakiseh, a bathroom, does the bathroom have to be used to gain the status of a bathroom? Or the fact that you built it as a bathroom already gives it a status of a bathroom? Beit Knesset, Beit Midrash, you build them for that purpose. Do they need to be utilized in order to gain that status? Or is that status bestowed upon it because that was your intent when you built it? So that's the concept here of Hazmana Milti or Lav Milti. Is preparation or designation sufficient enough to give something the classification of Kedusha or E-Kedusha, depending on the situation? So Abai says over here, if you make Tachrim for a mate, the intent for the mate is enough to make it a Surbana. Rav Amar Mutar Hazmana Lav Milti. Rav says, Mutar, preparations aren't enough. You have to use it in order to do a Surbana. My time into Abaye. What's the reason or logic behind Abaye's position? Gamar Sham Sham Egla Rufa. Learns out the word Sham Sham, the Gzer Shava. By Miriam it says Vayamat Sham. And by Egla Rufa it says Sham. Just like by Egla Rufa Bazmana Mitasra, as soon as you bring the ego down to the Nachal Eitan, it becomes a Surbana. Even before they kill the Egla Rufa, it's a Surbana even when it's brought down there. So do Ainami Bazmana Mitasra. So do anything associated with the mate. Any preparations that are done specifically for the mate also become asur ba'ana. Rava gamar sham sham evodat kochavim. He learns out vayamat sham by Miriam. It's the pasuk in Devarim, which says, asher avdu sham agoyim. So sham sham teaches you, mevodat kochavim, mevodat kochavim ba'azmana lo mitasra. Just like by avodah zarah, through azmana, just preparing something to worship does not make it into avodah zarah. Only once it's worshipped or used in worship does it become asur bana. Avakanami basmana lo mitasra. So by the mate, just preparing something for the mate does not make it asur bana. Only if it's used for the mate does it make it asur bana. Rava my time alo gamar me egla arufa. Why doesn't Rava learn from egla arufa? Amalacha mishamshim mashamshim gamrinat. We will learn out things that are used in a process from something that is used in a process, the fuge egla rufa, the igufa kdusha, versus the case of egla rufa, where the item that we're speaking about is inherently the item that is going to become kadosh or asur ba'ana'a. So we're talking about tachrichim or beged a mate, that's going to be used for the mate. It's mishamesh the mate. So too, with regards to avodah zarah, we're talking about things that are going to be used in the worship of avodah zarah. And Rashi brings the midrash halacha on that pasuk in Devarim to show that that pasuk is not speaking about avodah zarah itself, but rather things that are used in the worship of avodah zarah. So it's just like there, it's something used in the process, but not the item itself. So to hear by the mate, we're talking about tachrichim, which are used for the mate, but not the mate itself. Versus egla rufa, where the item itself is the kedusha, the item that's going to become kadosh or asur ba'ana. So that's why I'd rather learn from avodah zarah than egla arufa. But by my time alone, the Gamar Mevodat Kochovim. Why doesn't Abai learn from Avodah Zarah rather than from Egla Rufa? Amalei, Mide de Urchei, Mide de Urchei Gamrinan. Makes sense to do something that is in the proper process from something that's in the proper process. Making Tachrichim for the mate is something that's mutar and something that you should be doing or should be done for the mate. When it comes to Egla Rufa, this is the procedure that needs to be done in this situation. The proper thing is to bring the Egla Rufa down to Nachal Eitan. Then, by avodah zarah, you're doing something that's illegal. You're doing something that's against the Torah's prescription, and that's not orchei. So lafuke avodat kochavim delav orcha, which is not the right thing to be doing, and therefore he thinks that the comparison between egla rufa and mita is more appropriate than that between mita and avodah zarah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of memchet amud aleph.